The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everyone, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I'm your host, Jody Green, from the University of Nebraska. Today, we're recording part two of Women in Entomology show. In part one, we featured a historical perspective and touched upon a few challenges that women face in the field of science and entomology. And in part two, I'm interviewing four women who are employed in different aspects of entomology and also in different stages of their career. So one of our guests today is Dr. May Barenbaum. She is at the University of Illinois, and we talked about her a little bit on the part one, Women in Entomology, kind of talked about her behind her back, but she found out. And here's the interview I had with her. So I hope that you'll listen along and enjoy the show.
My attitude toward podcasts has been influenced by my 27-year-old daughter.
Oh, nice. Who's
an avid fan of podcasts, and she's living in Hollywood, and whenever I have a meeting out anywhere west of the Rocky Mountains, I visit her and look for things to do. So the last two visits, we've been to podcasts. We went to Pod Save America and we saw My Favorite Murder too. So.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I do a lot of commuting. So I, love podcasts.
And right.
It's what
she does.
Keeps me going.
She's in Los Angeles area. Mm-hmm. So she spends a lot of time in the car. So.
Yeah. So that's. And it's funny because Jonathan will say, well, I just released the, you know, the last one and I have to listen to it before I can tweet about it. And so I'm in the car. I'm like, what if something happens to me and people find my body listening to myself? Like, you know, what she was wearing, what she was eating, and she was listening to herself talk on a podcast. So very strange stuff.
That is so 21st century.
Yeah. Hopefully, I don't know if you listened to the last one, but hopefully I did you justice. I didn't go over anything that, I really focused on the Insect Fear Film Festival. And, one of the things, I mean, there are many things that you're known for and that different people admire you for, but for myself, your grand efforts, throughout your career to advocate for insects, like, you know, to all audiences. And that's something that I think, you know, we really strive to do. And so I wanted to really highlight that. But, how would you introduce yourself?
Well, you know, it's funny because on Twitter, I mean, I joined Twitter in 2009, actually, and it was still very kind of new back then, and you're supposed to describe yourself, and people have all kinds of clever, you know, strings of adjectives, or I just wrote entomologist, and it's been fine ever since. I think that pretty much says it.
Yeah.
I've been here as an entomologist for almost 38 years. I've been head of the department for 25 years. So if I'm not an entomologist by now.
You definitely are. And I think that I didn't even tag you in Twitter. Someone listened and, you know, tagged you on Twitter like, maybe your mom, you know. And so, you would have found out sooner or later that we were talking about you on the Twittersphere. But, you know, I think it's everyone always asks the why, you know, why you got into entomology. And I'm always, I question like what's something you want to be remembered for? Because there's so many things that we can do, but when, you know, we're not here anymore, what we would want people to remember us by.
Yeah. And of course one has no control over the future.
Mm-hmm.
Well, certainly, I am very gratified that the rest of the world has gained more of an interest in public understanding of science and science communication because it's been desperately needed. If anything, it's more needed now than it was even relatively recently. So, it's not a responsibility we can just offload onto professional science communicators. I think every scientist should have some skills, if nothing else, to interpret the publicly funded research to the public that's funding it. Absolutely essential, because all the work we do, almost all the work that is done in entomology is dependent upon the goodwill of the taxpaying public. So we owe it to them to explain how it is that there's a greater good associated with entomological research.
What do you think is one of the major challenges right now?
Oh, gosh, where do we start? Can we narrow that field down a bit? Because there's
challenges. How about, because this is, part two of Women in Entomology, how about what are some of current challenges that women face in entomology or science?
It's a hard one for me to answer. It's funny because I just saw a call, must have been on email, maybe it was Twitter. Women who have had issues in entomology with mansplaining.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember mansplaining being a problem. I think it might be because I probably talk faster than most men, so they don't have a chance to mansplain before I can put my two cents in. I don't know. But that's a good thing, that it's not a problem for everybody. I've often been a disappointment to people who invite me to be on panels to explain how I've sort of overcome prejudice, because I think I entered the field at a very opportune time. My mother actually was a scientist. She was a chemistry student as an undergraduate in Hunter College. And in fact, her best friend through high school and college was Gertrude Ellion, Trudy Ellion. And the two of them graduated from college with chemistry degrees. And it was extremely difficult for them to get work, despite the fact my mother had, I think, one of the highest scores on civil service exam for scientific aid. And Gertrude Ellion had to work as a volunteer for a year with a man named George Hitchings. Well, long story short, Trudy Ellion eventually won a Nobel Prize. Here's somebody starting out who was, who was recognized as exceptionally gifted, who couldn't even get a paying job. So I got this paying job in August 1980, 2 weeks after I deposited my thesis. And I've had this one job my entire adult life. So I was just, I think, extremely fortunate. I grew up in a family with two parents that were scientists who were delighted that their daughter wanted to be a scientist. So that's not true for a lot of people who entered the field during my era, which is getting more and more in the past now. This is probably a disappointing interview too. I don't have stories of hardship, but I am exceedingly grateful for every opportunity I've had. I had a very supportive committee in graduate school. I had a very supportive faculty who hired me with no postdoctoral experience in August 1980. I cannot complain. And I'm just ecstatic that that opportunities are opening up for more people. So maybe I should be, I don't know.
No, I think that's great. And I mean, I guess that's very hopeful for me, having a daughter. Both my husband and I are scientists, and everyone's got their own story. So,
I married a film professor and she wants to be in show business. So biology must be recessive to film studies. I don't know.
But I think the gratitude is so important. And, and everything that you've done to try to help the next generation. And so do you find that you want to try to encourage or make that possible for other young girls to make it as entomologists?
Absolutely. I am fully aware of how incredibly fortunate I've been, and I'm grateful for that. And it's kind of pay it forward, I guess. If I can help others in any way, absolutely. I mean, it's a daunting task. I think all scientists are now facing all kinds of issues. So when you started out the conversation, what's the greatest challenge? We have some enormous challenges in science communication in really critical areas right now. So I am worried about the future. But this is turning kind of dark, isn't it?
Okay, well, let's...
No, it's realistic.
And you know, Jonathan and I will go out and we will talk to other people about, yeah, how to communicate their science, because it's not necessarily all about entomology sometimes, but it's like, you know, if you're doing research or you're into science, then you need to be able to communicate that to your audiences and the stakeholders, you know, no matter what. So yeah, so everyone knows that what you're doing is important, because there are so many, I guess, places in, you know, the internet is a problem I have with a lot of times when I'm talking to people about having to prove that, I studied entomology. And so WD-40 is not the answer, right? That's a conversation I had yesterday. But, you know, so how this all started was that I posed a question on Twitter, because on Arthropod, I am one of three hosts and I'm the only female. And we really wanted to talk about women in entomology, and we wanted to talk about maybe some of the challenges that were there. And, the two guys, Jonathan and Mike, they talked about a historical perspective and, you know, a woman entomologist that they really admired. And, you know, mine was you. And, when I told Jonathan that you were at a giant meeting in California, he was surprised that I even, you know, reached out to you and that you would even want to talk on our little, podcast. So, that's why when we decided to do part two, because I got so many responses on Twitter, that I thought I would reach out to you again and see if you would like to be interviewed. And I think, sort of like you, I didn't really think.
I have to say one thing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pressure. I mean, I don't see myself as every time. Well, for example, you probably know I won the National Medal of Science, which is a really remarkable thing.
Yes.
Every time I do something stupid, I'm worried they're going to take it away from me. So, it's like a all-consuming concern here, because I'm not that impressed with myself, frankly.
Well, and I think sometimes all really impressive people aren't that impressed with themselves, you know? Like if you were like, yes, I'm the best. I stood beside the president and got a medal. And I think that's also a remarkable thing about you, is that you're humble, but you always give back. I am honored that I am actually even getting to talk to you. So,
it's an absolute pleasure. I'm just glad people are interested.
Yeah.
So you know my origin story, that I started. One reason I was so keen on public understanding and engagement is that when I got to college, I was actually entomophobic.
Yes, I did mention that on the last show.
So knowledge is power, and I can totally relate to people who think insects are icky, because I spent a good deal of my childhood in that mindset.
Right, and I thought I mean, one of the examples I had said is that, you know, if someone like you could be a complete entomophobe and then go on to change so many people's minds and be such a great role model to girls everywhere, you know, that there's so much power inside all of us to do that, right? It's only it's a spark. And some of the responses that I received were that, you know, some people didn't have good role models, some people did, but some of their challenges were, you know, that they thought that funding and resources and, you know, having a family were things that got in the way of career, when it, you know, which is a huge challenge in a woman's life.
Yeah, actually, that has been a challenge in a way, that, cause I did not get married till I was 35. Didn't have a kid till I was, 37. Is that right? Yeah. There was a biological clock issue. Mm-hmm. And, I had an offer from, this was 1992. I had an offer from Princeton, which is, you know, one of the Ivies. I have Ivy degrees. My undergrad and graduate degree are Ivy League. My entire family lives in the Northeast. But Princeton really didn't have anything for Richard, for my husband. And what I literally told Princeton is that it took me longer to find a husband than to get a PhD, and I did not want to start that process over again. So I said thanks anyway. And then in terms of kids, we have one daughter. I don't know how people manage to have more than one at a time.
And I'm with you there. I have one daughter.
I don't know how they did it, but I do remember, you know, this imposter syndrome. I got a call a few years ago. There's an award here that's called the Mom's Medallion, I guess, for at the University of Illinois to recognize moms. And I thought it was so ironic that the day I got that call, I was on my way to pick up my daughter in daycare to bring her home and serve for dinner pizza on paper plates. And I thought, again, they're going to take this thing away from me. So, so there's imposter syndrome can affect not just your professional life, but your personal life too. So,
yeah, I can relate to that. I often feel like that I'm really hard on myself as a mom. I don't know. I think that, but I think that a lot of moms feel that way, you know, and nobody really knows what they're doing. You know, we just do the best we can with what we've got.
Yeah, it's a hard job.
Absolutely. Do you, I mean, and there was another, a couple of people that had mentioned, like, you know, they really admire women entomologists that make it. And so, you know, a lot of times we don't even know if we're making it, but there's people that, you know, look up to us or admire us, and they think that we're on the right track. So do we have any advice on how to get them to where they need to be if they want to, you know, be a faculty member or a professor or an industry? What can we do or what can they do or any advice to get them on that path?
Actually, I just had a conversation with a graduate student, happened to be male, but this morning, about career paths. And I guess the advice I've given to many people, if you're in graduate school, you want to, you know, become a scientist, it really has to be your passion. You can't go into the field of entomology for fame or fortune, because that's not going to work out probably in most cases. Mm-hmm. But pursue your passion. Because that's what's going to get you through the adversity, you know. I think that's really the best advice. Don't do it if you hate it, because that then you won't have the momentum to carry you through. I don't know if that's good, bad, or indifferent, but I really think it's an important driver. Because I, you know, people sometimes don't understand why, but they're surprised. I have had so many rejections. I mean, drawers full of grants that have been rejected, papers that have been, you know, from low-level journals have been turned down even by crummy journals, you know? But I'm invested in the science, that's fine. I'll just power through it. So, yeah, I was just the other day telling somebody about a paper that the reviewers basically said words to the effect that I questioned the entire scientific basis of this work, which was
that's harsh.
Crushing. Yeah. It was not a high-profile journal, and I managed to get it submitted to another even lower-profile journal, and it's had, since publication, it's been cited almost 300 times. So I think the reviewer was wrong. But I had to have that belief in my own work that I didn't basically walk away and, I don't know, try to get a job pumping gas somewhere. Mm-hmm. Although, yeah, nobody pumps gas anymore. If they even pump gas in New Jersey anymore, do they? No.
I don't know. Isn't there one state that it's illegal to pump your own gas?
Either Oregon or New Jersey. Yeah. I need a new metaphor. So.
Okay, so this happens to me a lot when people say, tell me one fun fact about you. And I feel like there are so many strange things that I'm so desensitized to what would actually be fun. And so when I was, you know, making notes about you, I was like, I wonder what her fun fact would be, because there are just so many interesting things about you that, like, it's interesting to know what's your fun fact.
Jeez, I don't know what would be fun. I don't know if people, it's not fun. It was kind of the bane of my existence. My middle name is Roberta, which I'm not fond of. I don't know if that's a fun fact or not.
No, that is. It's interesting because, you know, there's so many, I watched.
And my apologies to the Robertas out there. It's a respectable name, but I'm glad it was not my first name. Let's leave it at that.
No, that's good to know. Cause, you know, to have like an X-Files character named, you know, after you and all the other things. Like, and so, you know, I've got some, strange things in my past as well, but my fun fact was like, I've never used an emoji. And everyone thinks, you know, oh, okay, that's interesting. But yeah, I really, you know, I don't know anyone else who has a character on X-Files named after them, but I've seen it and I've heard your comments about it. And I just think it's hilarious.
I have said I got more email about having an X-Files character named with my name,
Bambi,
than I did getting elected to the National Academy of Sciences. So
it's just the interesting things that, you know, that you'll be remembered by. After all you've done.
I guess that is more fun than Roberta. So.
No, well, I learned something new.
There you go. Yeah.
I don't know. Anything in closing that you would want to pass on?
Thank you for, I'm honored to be interviewed, frankly. And I'm surprised that your fellow podcasters were surprised. I don't know why I wouldn't, want to be interviewed.
And that's why I told him, I said, you know, from all that we know about her, this is her thing, you know, like to reach out and to pass that on, to pay that forward. So, and that's what we try to do with this podcast. So that's why I reached out to you and I'm completely honored.
Well, how can I refuse a request from a podcast with the coolest name ever? So.
Well, thank you so much. We'll let you get back to teaching and all the other things that you've got to do.
Sounds good. And you keep podcasting.
Oh, we will. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Bye. Yeah. Okay. So let's just start off. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Okay. My name's Karen Walker, and I work for USDA at the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, APHIS.
Nice. Okay. So when we decided to do a Women in Entomology show or podcast show, and I reached out on Twitter and I asked some women entomologists if they had any challenges or anything to talk, you know, to say about their ideas and perspective of being a woman in entomology. And her name was Colleen. She mentioned you as a resource to discuss gender inequity in entomology. And so that's why we reached out to you. And so, you know, we're very honored to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So to start, how did you get interested in this topic?
Well, I got my degree in 1997. So I've been working as an entomologist for a little over 20 years. And of course, I noticed in grad school that it was mostly men. It's probably was worse then than maybe when you went through. But and then I noticed when I would go to meetings that there would be very few women. So I kept thinking to myself, you know, maybe this will be an interesting study to look at how many men there are versus women giving presentations. So then I started looking at it from that point of view. And from there, I went on to looking at two employment sectors in entomology, one academia, and then the second, the federal government. I have not looked at industry, but that's the third major area that I would want to look at some point.
Can you say what you found?
Yeah, I found that just like other people have done with other STEM employment, that women are really underemployed. The results that I have right now, which I'm writing up in a manuscript and I'm getting ready to submit, suggest that in both of those employment sectors, that it's about 75% men, 25% women. And then if you look at increasing levels of responsibility, say going from postdoc up to emeritus professor, and looking with the federal government going from lower grades to higher grades, the concentration or proportion of women decreases significantly and in sort of a linear fashion. So, and then of course for men, it's the opposite way.
Is there anything in the research that can indicate why that is?
Not really, but a lot of researchers have done similar work in this area, and they've suggested, I don't know how familiar you are with this, but there's this leaky pipeline hypothesis, which is an older hypothesis that sort of suggests that it's something that, when you see results like this, that it is the decisions that the women make kind of willingly are responsible for this. And that kind of annoyed me when I would read all this stuff. And I thought, yeah, you know, that can't really be. That hypothesis says that, you know, women don't compete as much for jobs because they want to have babies or they want to have part-time jobs, you know, and these to me, although there's a certain amount of truth behind that, of course, there are some women that decide that they're going to have kids before going on. I don't think it's as cut and dried as the proponents of this hypothesis would suggest. So I think I looked at, in the paper that I'm writing, I looked at some other potential reasons like implicit and explicit bias against women.
Mm-hmm.
So without doing further research, it's really difficult to say. I mean,
right.
You know, it would be a lot of work, and hopefully, you know, there's a way that some other people could get together with me and work on this in the future to uncover this.
I mean, that there is a clear gender gap, but the explanation is not clear. And when you said, you know, it's the choices that women make. And I think to my own self, and yes, I've made these choices, you know, to follow my spouse or stay married and have a child. And so, you know, did I make those conscious decisions to be out of the workforce and to have delayed my career? Yes. But there are all these other circumstances because I'm a woman that,
right,
that put those in my court to make those decisions, right?
Right. And there's plenty of other research suggesting, looking at, you know, publication of women, not necessarily mm-hmm. in entomology, but in other STEM subjects, suggesting that, you know, men are much more represented as authors than women. So that doesn't mm-hmm. seem to make a lot of sense.
Right. Actually, yeah. Was that part of the study that said a lot of times they're cited more often because they're more often citing themselves?
Yeah, there is a study like that. And then there's, you know, I don't want to get into any
yeah.
any guys because everybody loves men. But, you know, there is evidence to suggest that men are better at promoting themselves than women. Women tend to, you know, particularly that's probably true with older women like me. You know, you're brought up to try to be modest and not, you know, call much attention to yourself. So I think, you know, it's a combination of factors, but I really was interested in this partially because of my own kind of trajectory through, you know, having a career in entomology, because I'm not sad about the way that I did it, but at the time that I was in grad school, I already had one child. And then after I graduated, I had two more, and I decided that I would stay home until the youngest one was six. But little did I know that then that meant that the entomology world, especially mm-hmm. doing any kind of research, kind of felt that, well, you're stale and we're not going to hire you. So I think that's kind of unfair.
Mm-hmm. And how did you end up getting back into a career?
Well, what I did was I actually worked for almost 8 years as a gypsy moth, a mosquito entomologist running a pest control program for a local government in Virginia. And then after that, I had sort of another hiccup because I got cancer. And so I had to take time off to recover from that. And then since I didn't explain this earlier, but before I went back to grad school, I had worked at EPA.
Okay.
Embattled mm-hmm. agency right now, but then it was a lot different. And so since I had been a government employee, it was probably a little easier for me to get a job with USDA at that point. Mm-hmm. But I would have been happier doing research than doing what I'm doing now, which is more regulatory stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of this has to do with the rigid way that a lot of the STEM subjects are considered, and you've got to take a certain path all the way through grad school and beyond. And you've got to go do a postdoc, and mm-hmm. you've got to, you know, publish X number of papers. And, you know, at the time, maybe I was just kind of naive, but I didn't know that you had to do all that stuff. I thought that, oh, I could stay home with my kids, and then I'd be able to go back to a reasonably, you know, neat career. But it didn't work like that.
Do you think nowadays some women are choosing to not, you know, work that kind of rigid schedule, you know, ahead of time, and so that's why we have so, you know, is it almost equal in terms of our degrees in school, but then when it comes to faculty positions, you know, it's predominantly more male.
Yeah, it is predominantly more male. I mean, the data that I looked at for academia is that I looked at it in 2016. So that was only 2 years ago. And it's about 50% male and female graduate students mm-hmm. and about the same for postdocs. But when you get into extension specialists, an assistant professor, then it goes down to about 25% females. So, you know, something is going on. I don't know what it is. You know, I've got a lot of female entomologist friends that sort of think that maybe there is this bias, and you're probably aware that there have been a call to have double blind reviews of publications and also applications for positions. So I think that, you know, that's why people are asking for this, because they're worried that there is a gender bias.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice for entomologists, particularly girls and women that, you know, are trying to make it?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping that things are going to change, and I'm working with some other people to bring a workshop to the ESA conference in Vancouver this year to get the leadership in a lot of academic and government facilities to learn what's implicit bias, that maybe you really are everybody's bias, let's mm-hmm. face it, about something. So I think if that happens and there's enough people that go to that, that'll be useful. As far as what individual people should do, you know, the other thing that's kind of a catch-22, and this has, you know, been suggested by other people, not just me, that the time that you're in grad school and trying to establish a career tends to coincide with your years of peak fertility. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can make a decision, well, I think I'll get my career started. But then you have to work for a certain number of years to get tenure. And then by the time that maybe you want to get pregnant, you're not so fertile anymore. Or the other way around, you can do what I did. And I hope that you know, now it's not so bad as, I don't know, 15 years ago when my youngest was six. But, you know, unless the kind of, I hate to call them the ruling class, but the, another author called them, men are the gatekeepers in professional entomology. And unless they're willing or pressured to change things, I think it's going to be difficult. Mm-hmm. And you, as I can see, you're much younger than I am, so I'm sure you have more recent experience in this.
Well, and there's a lot of things that I had never really considered until we tweeted that out and, you know, someone said about, you know, following your spouse. I was like, yeah, I did that, you know, but, and it was a, we sat down, we're like, are we really going to stay together? Can we, can we have careers in two different states? You know,
Right.
And then, you know, if I thought, sometimes I think if I knew I could only have one child, would I still have done it? You know, because of this gap. And, I'm less of a scientist. I'm less of as a professional. I haven't had a strong career. You know, I'm just almost just getting started, it seems, you know, in my 40s. So, but, you know.
When did you graduate?
In 2008 from Purdue.
Oh, okay.
And, I didn't have a lot of female role models. And
yeah,
so I think, problem. You know, that it helps to have that and not being, I guess around the association. 'Cause when I wasn't working, I couldn't afford to go to ESA meetings. I had no funding. And then I had a baby, so I couldn't, you know, go to these meetings and without all that debt, you know, and I wasn't working, so I wasn't bringing any money in.
Right.
I couldn't get out there and network. I didn't know how to, you know, try to stay as current as I could. So when I could get back into the workforce, that I would be, you know, doing something, that I was passionate about and something that I was good at and something I studied, you know, in school.
I think that, you know, graduate programs, hopefully they've gotten better. And I will say, you know, I mean, I thought my advisor was a great person and a helpful person, but I don't think that, at least at the time that I graduated, there was really this recognition, first of all, that jobs are going to be difficult to get. And sometimes when I chat with people, professors that are at my alma mater, I get the impression that they still don't really understand that, you know, it's really hard to get, especially an academic job. And then it's even harder as a woman. And I think that the graduate programs need to, you know, try to prepare their students better than they did when I was in school. Now, I don't know what they did 10 years ago when you were in school, hopefully more than they did then. But I mean, I've talked to some grad students at meetings who have said that their male advisors will take the guy students out when somebody comes to town, you know, a collaborator or somebody from business, but they won't take the women. And, you know, stuff like that, that makes it difficult and makes women feel like, hey, you know, what's wrong with me?
Yeah, and that was something that came up on Twitter, like the lack of inclusion, right? If female faculty's members aren't often included when there's someone, a visiting scientist or a politician, policymakers, they also said less resources, less travel support, less tech time, and then salary. So, I agree with that. And you know, and what you're saying is, I mean, I had problems with that when I, was consulting and I had to, travel to give a talk somewhere. I didn't have the luxury of spending the night and getting to eat and drink, you know, and network with people because I needed to get home to my family. And so, you know, if they would have, so I did feel excluded, even though that also, again, was my choice.
I think a lot of it is, you know, we have to go back to the beginning. And I hate to say this, but maybe there's too many, I think, you know, maybe this will sound kind of unfair, but I think that there's probably too many PhDs being produced because there's just not enough jobs mm-hmm. for them. And I know, for example, the job that I have now, I mean, I'm glad I did the PhD. It gives me a feeling of accomplishment, you know, especially on the rare occasion when somebody, you know, treats me like I know something. But, you know, the job that I have now, since I'm not doing research, I mean, I could have done it with a master's degree. And I, a lot of times I feel kind of ripped off that I spent all this time doing this work thinking that I was going to get an academic job somewhere, sometime, or do research. And that mm-hmm. didn't happen. And it just seems, again, I don't know if it's still this way. I'd like to talk with some students still coming or just coming out, but it seems kind of like if you decide to have a kid or you work part-time or you follow your spouse or your partner or you go, you know, you do something a little bit different, that you're going to be marked down compared to other candidates. And I don't know why it's like that, and I don't think it's right.
Right. No, I agree with you. Those choices.
I mean, again, I hope it's getting better than it used to be. I mean, I remember when I had been out of grad school for about a year, this female entomologist told me, and she was really serious about it, she said, you cannot have kids and be an entomologist at the same time. And she never had any kids, and I don't know whether she's happy about it or not, but, you know, it really shouldn't be like that.
And, you know, I think that is something that is still out there. I've had a couple young entomologists or girls, women that are interested in becoming entomologists saying that they're still being told that. And that, you know, that it's sad that if, you know, they know I want to be an entomologist and that's what I want my career to be, but they told me, you know, that it's sad that I'll never have kids. And so
these are faculty that are telling them that?
I think these are students.
Really?
But,
well,
yeah.
That's sad. I mean, people need to get, you know, we should embrace this as part of the Me Too movement.
Right. We need to be their role models and tell them they can have it all.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if it's going to be accepted, but there is a symposium about this issue in addition to the workshop that I already talked about, and I was invited to give a talk there as well. So
what's the do you know what the symposium name is?
I don't, although Gail Campmeyer and some other people are putting it together, so I haven't heard whether it's going to go through yet. So
okay, so that's a possible symposium that we can look for at the ESA meeting in Vancouver in November.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe we can sort of have, you know, get some people together and hang out and talk about some of these issues. Because, you know, professionally, throughout my life, whenever I've talked about this, I hear from men that, oh, no, you know, there's no gender bias in entomology. There's just as many women as there are men, you know. And even after I've done this research and I show them the data, They still continue to insist that it's not true. So, I don't know. Yeah. I wish things were differently. I hope that things will change. Hopefully in my lifetime, you know, certainly in yours.
Well, hopefully. But so the takeaway should be that us women need to stick together because we're definitely stronger together, right? We build each other up.
Yeah. And I think there's a certain number of women, and particularly older women, I think, that tend to not want to rock the boat too much. Mm-hmm. But then again, you know, the woman, Colleen, that you talked about, she said to me that she thinks that there are a lot of women that are younger that are just getting started, and they're scared to complain about gender equity. And that might be true, too. So in a way, I kind of have the luxury of working on this because I'm established and I'm a government job, so it's a stable job. So And I don't know whether that's true for younger women or not, but I suspect it might be. Well, so I think it's kind of a, you know, sort of like a little revolution needs to take place, I think.
Well, I think it's starting. So that's a good step. But I have to say that I really appreciate the work that you've done and the information that you've provided today.
Okay.
And I look forward to meeting you. Is there anything else that you want to mention on the podcast?
Not really. Just, you know, try to encourage women to stand up for their rights and, you know, get mentoring and attention from their faculty advisors and as much as possible.
Okay.
You know.
Yep.
And hopefully it will follow through. But I look forward to meeting you as well. Appreciate you inviting me to participate.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Okay.
Bye. Bye. Our next guest for our Part 2 Women in Entomology is Dr. Marianne Elaine. Marianne, or M, as you are called. Welcome to Arthropod. Can you please tell the listeners where you're located and a little bit about yourself?
I'm at the University of Illinois, currently sitting in the entomology department. I've been here a long time. I got my PhD in Illinois, and for the last almost 20 years, I have been a research scientist. Oh, it's not as bad. It's 15 years, I think, that I've been. I'm a scientist, and I teach and I do research and all that kind of fun.
Yeah. How did you get involved with entomology in the study of insects in the first place?
Well, I view myself primarily as a biologist. I'm trained as a biologist. I did my undergrad in biology. And then during my undergrad, actually, I first started at a community college when I first came to the U.S. I'm from the Netherlands, and so I started at a community college, and I went through a guest lecture on parasites, and I thought that was just so awesome. Then I finished my undergrad at Berkeley and did something completely different on the energetics of locomotion in invertebrates. But my advisor there, Bob Pohl, knew that I was very interested in parasites, and he met Nancy Beckage, who is at the University of California at Riverside, and he said, I think you will really like her and you like her work. You should see if you maybe can do a master's with her. And so I did. I had never considered going beyond just a college degree. I'm even the first one in my family to go to university. So graduate school was not even, I had no clue what that was. But I went to Riverside and had a, it was fantastic. I loved working on parasites. They're great in entomology, right? Because they're, first of all, you don't have to deal with blood, like human blood. It's easy to rear them. It's easy to study them. So I view them as models. I wasn't actually that fond of insects. I was actually kind of scared of them. Parasitology and entomology go very well together. And so that's what I did.
That's really cool. And you're pretty lucky that someone knew you well enough and, gave you that little nudge and encouraged that, relationship. And I know, that we can discuss later on that, Dr. Nancy Beckage is one of your role models. And so it continued to be, a really positive influence in your life. Can you discuss some of your courses that you teach and what some of them mean to you? I especially love your bio inspiration. I got looking on your blog and I couldn't stop. And so it was very distracting to me, but it was very fascinating. I feel like it is a really good gateway for non-entomologists to get interested in insects. So, you know, whenever there's a pull for normal people, sometimes, you know, we say, to really get interested and get excited, you know, that spark. So please tell me a little bit about that.
Okay, so going back to the classes that I teach, what I consider my bread and butter is that I teach insect physiology, which is what I was trained in, and that is the core class that all graduate students here at Illinois have to take. And so that's what I teach. And that's great because that gives me the opportunity to get to know the graduate students, and it's every 2 years, and to try and stay up to date in insect physiology. But then, over the, and then I've also, I teach insect pathology, so it's a sort of a subtopic of insect physiology, and that comes from my background in parasitology. And then, the last 10 years, I've been teaching on bio-inspiration, bio-inspired design, other people call it biomimicry, and, where that actually comes from is because I am married to an engineer.
Okay.
And, so we have a lot of discussions, like I would come home and go, oh, insects can do a really cool thing. And he would always be like, yeah, whatever. You know, can they fly 500 people across an ocean? Like, no, but, you know, so I started, I had to make my case almost every day that insects are really cool and that nature is very cool. Like nature in general, but then it's great to use insects as an example. And biomimicry became more popular, so I suggested that we should start teaching some courses on this topic. Also, because the university always says we want multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary courses and research projects and so on. So this is a great way to bring biology and engineers together.
So do you collaborate with him?
With him? No.
Okay.
That's probably we collaborate on things.
Okay, yeah.
So since I did start teaching that, engineers have approached me and want to collaborate. So I have some fantastic collaborations with engineers here on campus and also some other engineers across the country. And just because I started teaching and I started blogging, and it's kind of sad that blogging does these days, but if I had more time, I would love to write more for that blog. I mean, I don't think I'm a great writer, but it was always such a good thing to put my thoughts on paper or online and to think about them, not just when I'm teaching. And wish I had more time to do that.
Yeah, no, I hear you for that. I did hear that blogging was dead, and I didn't even get around to starting my blog. That's how busy I actually was. So, I mean, I can understand that.
It took me like 3 years of me saying I was going to do it to finally do it. That's also so sad to think about, I don't have anything to contribute, or if I put that out there, then everybody will know that I'm not that smart, or you know that. Those kinds of things that hold us back, and you're like, five people read the first blog, the post. What does it matter? Why does it matter that it is? Yeah, why did I wait so long? Yeah,
so it's like that hindsight.
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah, and it's true. And I've talked to two other women so far, and they both mentioned imposter syndrome. So that's interesting. But you are big on Twitter, right?
Yeah, also there for a while, and didn't quite know what that was for and what it could do for me. And I do really separate, so Facebook is where family and friends, and then Twitter I really try to, that's where my science is, even though a lot of those people have become my friends. So, and then at first I was very hesitant on sharing maybe family stuff or political stuff, but now I don't care. Right.
I keep separation too, and I know because I have UNL in my Twitter handle. I try not to be controversial at all. So if I do post pictures of my family, it's bug related or pest management related. Can you tell us your Twitter handle? And do you have a story?
Remember the password.
Because you're their number one fan, right? First love. I thought it was because it was your first love.
Yeah, it was my first love. They're the parasitic and the iconic parasitic voice that I work on for my master's. So they parasitized maybe the sex stuff, which is what I did for my master's. And then later for my PhD, I worked on other species that parasitized smaller pyralis and sandals. So, I did that at Illinois with Rob Eden. And, that's where that came from.
Well, I like it. I really enjoy and appreciate the many ways and the resources that you use to teach your audience. being in science, you know, communication and extension, outreach, it kind of all blends together on trying to get science out there to different people. And we try our best to use different methods and different ways to do it. I know you've used social media, the blog that you mentioned, different online classes, Twitter, forums. Can you tell me which ones maybe work the best for specific audiences and maybe things that you tried that maybe didn't go so well?
Well, I think 4 years ago when I used the Twitter lectures, I thought they were fantastic. They went really well. Like I think being cognizant of the history of the field is important too. Mm-hmm. So I would ask the students, rather than what we did traditionally, is write an essay about Wigglesworth or Carol Williams or something like that. It's like, why don't you do a Twitter lecture to see if you can reach more people and that you're actually writing something for the whole audience, for a big audience rather than just for me, the grader. Because that, of course, also changes how people approach the project. So I did Twitter and I went really well. This year I'm trying again and it's not, and I've tried it since then multiple times and I see it's just decreasing. I think students are just not on Twitter. This year it's not going so well, so I don't, and I have no idea how I can do it on using, Instagram. It's just not.
Yeah.
Just sharing links and stuff, and, what's the other one? Snapchat.
I don't even know how to do that one.
Right, that's what students are.
Yeah.
How I can do it in my teaching, but I just don't know. So I guess I'm just waiting for the next great thing, and then I'll see if I can use it for teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could make students understand how great Twitter is, but I guess I can't.
I can't even encourage my husband to, you know, join Twitter. He, I don't know.
Yeah.
Some people are just very resistant. I mean, the one thing I like about it is just that it's pretty concise. And you have to, you have to think a lot to post something.
It's going to be part probably of your, in your interview and those kinds of things. So that's all the reason why I'm interested in that.
No, I think it's really important. You know, having been through grad school, I was never, comfortable with public speaking or getting up and doing a presentation, the student competitions or anything like that. If I could get out of it, I would. And now, you know, they're like, oh, here, there's like 300 people. And I'm like, okay, or here, you're on the radio or on TV. And that wasn't ever what I expected or even that I still feel comfortable with, you know. So, but it, you know, to have to take it, it's kind of like every time you do it, you're just, you hope for the best.
Podcasts right now are really popular. And from 2 years ago when I taught the class, I had 20 students, and I think maybe two or three are still pretty active on Twitter, and one of them, it has a really popular podcast. I don't want to say that was because of my class, but if that is, if that's what comes out of it, then I'm pretty happy with that.
Yeah,
I don't have to convince everybody that this is the way to go.
But, right. Yeah. You're doing your part. Well, I've seen from your Twitter handle and your photo there, and we just talked that you were from the Netherlands. So you're an immigrant and you're a woman. Did either of these things create, you know, specific challenges for you along your path to become a research scientist?
No, but, you know, I'm very well aware that even though I'm an immigrant, I am, you know, I'm one of the, especially in the political climate now, I'm one of those immigrants that are, oh gosh, how do you say that? Like, I'm from Western Europe. I mean, that's the one, you know, people that are probably welcome. But at the same time, I need to make sure that I recognize that other immigrants are not as fortunate, as I am. And, the fact that I had no exposure to higher education for my family. Actually, being an immigrant, the benefit is that, U.S. educational system, or at least when I first came here, I got the best of both worlds. Like, I went to high school in the Netherlands, which was very good. And then I went to college in the U.S., and even though if I had gone to college in the Netherlands, I would have studied medicine, and there was no way I could change my mind. You had to stop, right?
Okay.
You know, state paid for it. You don't have to, you can't to change your mind as much. Whereas in the U.S., I had, yes, I was going to study medicine, but then I realized, no, it's parasites. And
yeah.
I was also taking really cool history classes and things like that. So, yeah, so that was a benefit. Otherwise, I don't think so. Being an immigrant for me was difficult. And then I'm also married to an immigrant whose family's from Jamaica. So there's like a whole other, differences, cultural differences. But at the same time, we're very similar. And his family, there's like a whole ton of doctors and lawyers and professors and so on. So, yeah.
Well, what I met you, or I've known about you, actually. I think you came to Purdue and gave a seminar years and years ago when I was a student there. But when I reached out to women entomologists on Twitter asking about challenges that they faced in science, you had responded something about being the trailing spouse. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted for you to elaborate on that and have a little bit of discussion on what that means and how that changes things for women.
Yeah. You know, on the one hand, I wish I was, but it just is.
Mm-hmm.
We're in two separate fields. So maybe then you don't have as many choices on where you can end up in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, when we were looking, it was also very uncommon to have spousal hierarchies in the same department. And he has always been 2 years ahead of, now he's probably like 20 years ahead of me. Yeah, and he's very, very accomplished. And I've been very accomplished. And so it always seems like we say that we make a decision together, but, you know, he's the one that always makes the more money, or he has the more at stake. And so that's just the way it is. But we've always made choices together, and I'm happy with all my choices. And if I were to say I'm done with this place and want to leave Illinois, I can't stand in it. I'm sure he would leave. But that's not the case. We love it here. He loves his department. I love my department. So, we're happy.
No, that's good.
That's what I mean by the same spouse, that he's always a little bit ahead. It could have also been me, but, it's happening. He's a little older and he was, already a graduate student. I was still undergrad and he left. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I guess in some situations where if it's a woman entomologist and they maybe aren't as happy to live in a certain place, or maybe there isn't the jobs, the job opportunities in entomology especially, that would make it difficult.
Right. I've been very, very fortunate. So my position is a research position, not tenure track, so that maybe it's not ideal that way. But at the same time, it was negotiated between engineering and entomology. I think everybody benefits from it. I have had zero guilt about being a working mom. My kids are now teenagers. They're going to be fine. It's a lot of work. And if you were both traveling and are both on the same track, it's hard, very hard. So.
Yes, it is very difficult. I'm also not in a tenure position, but I do know the stress of even just having one child and two parents that travel a lot, and so that makes it difficult.
And no family nearby.
That we're in as well. You're very involved with ESA. Do you want to talk a little bit about your roles there and
how that started?
Yeah.
Well, when I was a graduate student, I won a fellowship, the Dorothy Fair Travel Fellowship. And one of the requirements was when you got it, you had to show up at a business meeting of the section, and that's on it's called Section B. It's now Section PDC, so that's Physiology and Biochemistry and Toxicology. And so I showed up to business meeting. I was like, oh wow, all the big people are here, and they're all working hard together to make this section better. And then I've been to every business meeting ever since. So and that is also again just the people are so great, and I working with my friends and meeting new people, and so the staff is wonderful, and so every time I just take on another job. And the Scientology Fellowship was like perfect also. That's something I've always been interested in, science policy and science communication. So when that came about, I was on it. I want to do that. And that was great. That's a wonderful experience.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all the work that you do for that.
Oh yeah. The staff though is really important too. The executive director, David Gammel, and then Chris Delton, who was doing the science policy stuff, are wonderful. So, yeah.
How did you manage, juggling everything, going to meetings, professional meetings throughout your career?
When kids were really little, I just went to one. I just went to ESA. And that was always, I put that already on the calendar. Year ahead of time. My husband was not allowed to travel at the time, and he knew it, right? That's the one time. So for me, it was okay, and I was taking them. Like, when in San Diego, they had the child care. I took them with me. They had one or two. I took them with me, and it was all right. But it was also really nice, and it's now really nice to go by myself and get a good night's sleep. I definitely see what I do in the evenings at a conference differently now than when I was a graduate student. That's for sure.
So yeah.
I have my own room. Yay.
Yeah, absolutely. This last branch meeting that we were in up by Madison, I took my daughter and my husband for the first time, and it was not the same. I was like, "Where's my space? How am I going to practice? How am I going to get any work done?" You know, it was like having college roommates.
Yeah. So that was hard. I really miss a lot of there, but now I miss a lot of the science at the ESA meetings because I'm all these other meetings.
Yeah.
You know, like, and now especially on the governing board, you hardly see any of the science. So that's why I've graduated from this.
So what do you see that we're doing, or the association, or fellow women entomologists can do to help younger up-and-coming women in science or entomology?
I'm really, really proud of ESA for taking the lead on this and the whole Me Too thing. And that's probably something I'm most proud of now, something that I've accomplished. I was on the Austin Program Committee. And at the time, my former advisor, Rob Biederman, was the president. And right around that time, a colleague of mine here at Illinois, Chase Clancy, was publishing these papers or this study about sexual harassment in the field of anthropology, human anthropologists. And also then the story started coming up about sexual harassment at meetings. Mm-hmm. And so I called Rob and I said, this is happening. I'm sure this happens in entomology too. Even though me personally, I have no bad experiences in that way. And so he was excellent. He started. He had some short sort of newsletter essays that he put out about how this is not acceptable and that we should be aware of it. And that's when that's called that statement that. ESA puts up about conduct, the code of conduct.
Yep.
That's where that came from. So I'm pretty proud of that.
Sort
of putting the people together, and then Gwen Pearson.
The Ento allies.
The Ento allies. Yep. And then the Me Too thing with Michelle Grenis and Hal Stafford last year. It was great. that's wonderful. And so I'm proud that we're leaders. We're not perfect because there's, what can you do? Where are the limits? That's what the staff is still working on. But I think just having it out there and making other people aware of where there might be, inadequacies, is very important. And it's not just women, it is just diversity. Mm-hmm. Diversity.
Yep.
And it is already so much better than it was when I was first hired out as a graduate student. So I'm very proud of that. So we're now also considered leaders.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
So the last thing I wanted, I asked other women entomologists about some of their role models, and you had 5 in your list. If you could, Beckage, Anelli, Beckenmeyer, Donkel, and Cox, if you think about each one of these people, if you could say like one word or one sentence so that we know that maybe this is what we want to emulate and pass forward, that character, something about, you know, that person.
So they're, all of them are members of the section that I am a member of. So they're all physiologists. And they all are there at the business and they do great science. They all organize symposia. So, and are always talking to me and talking to other women and including them. And then Nancy was my master's advisor, and she passed away a couple of years ago. And she was a great role model, super, super smart, doing really amazing work. But at the same time, and also being a single mom, also, you know, having to live through some of the hard parts of the families and not shying away of sharing that with me. So I learned a lot from that too. So, yeah. But all those women, I still go to ESA. So they're maybe like a generation ahead of me.
Mm-hmm.
And they're wonderful. Yeah.
And how would you like to be remembered?
Oh, God. somebody who used to be scared of insects, but promoted the importance of insect research and funding, and that's hopefully what I'm doing.
You absolutely are. I am honored to be able to speak with you today.
Thank you
for making the time. Our fourth guest for our part 2, Women in Entomology, is here with us now. Can you please tell us a little about yourself, first stating your name?
Sure. So my name is Rebecca Schmidt, or Rebecca Schmidt Jeffress, if you feel like including the hyphen part. My position is I'm an assistant professor at Clemson University, and I have both research and extension responsibilities in that position. I've been there for a little bit over a year.
Well, I just want to say welcome, and it's great to see you again. We met at ESA in Denver. We were sitting right beside each other, and we didn't know we were tweet pals, so it was very exciting to meet you. I have seen some of your YouTubes and your videos, and I do follow you on Twitter, and congratulations on your last presentation at your alma mater. That must have been a very great experience for you and for all your audience, too.
It was so great, because that department is, like, really, truly a departmental family, because it's very teaching-centered university. So, yeah, it was just feeling like getting to go hang out with my uncles and aunts again.
Yeah, well, why don't you tell the listeners where you went to school?
Sure. So, I got my bachelor's degree from the biology department at Washburn University, which is interesting in that I tend to call it a small liberal arts school, but it's actually one of the few municipal universities left in the country, so it's kind of like a city-run school. So it's pretty cool in that respect. So that's where I went. I got to go there and be part of the Kansas Academy of Sciences meeting.
That's awesome. And then where did you get your graduate degrees?
So I only have one graduate degree. I got a PhD from Washington State University back in 2015 in entomology.
Okay, so you're a relatively new faculty member, so congratulations for that. This all stems, this interview is part 2. Part 1, we did a little bit of looking at women in history from entomology. And when I put out that tweet, you were the first person to respond to the tweet of some of the challenges that we have as women in entomology or the sciences. Do you, or your response?
Yeah, I should probably spend too much of my time on Twitter, but it's good. So I respond, sometimes I respond more quickly than I feel like I should. So one of the things I said was, people telling you you're only here because you're a woman, this idea that they needed this token minority. And that was actually something that I've never personally experienced, but a very close colleague and friend of mine specifically had said to her fairly recently, so it was really fresh in my noggin. And the other thing I said is that sometimes, like, your clientele or your growers or stakeholders, whoever you're working with, might not take you seriously, especially if you're in a male-dominated industry. And I specifically mentioned agriculture, which is where I'm at.
Yeah, so do you want to share any of those experiences that you've had?
So I think in the grand scheme of things, especially talking to people that are more at the intersection of intersectionality, especially female minorities, I've had the most minor of minor aggressions. So you kind of leave feeling like, did you say that and or act that way because I'm female, or are you just a grumpy person? So it's kind of hard to pinpoint, but I had one farmer comment on, I have the world's tiniest like nose piercing, and he said something about like, and, you know, this was, like, fresh after being introduced. Like, if you pulled that out of your nose, all your brains would come pouring out. It was so weird. It's so weird. And, like, it detracts from the whole, especially as, like, an introduction, like, doing a meet and greet with farmers. Yeah. You're just like, what? And why? Mm-hmm. And how?
So do you think maybe that was more of a cultural difference?
Yeah, so you're just like, would you have commented on, like, it's just weird to comment on somebody's personal appearance when you're first meeting them in a professional setting. So you're just like, maybe you would have said that if I was a dude, maybe you wouldn't have, I don't know, because this is weird.
Right. I know, it's hard to say if that's, yeah. And I mean, how many times a day when I am meeting with people do I want to say, did you say that because of the, you know, in calling them out on it, but then, I don't know.
Yeah, and it's exhausting to spend your brain power on that sort of activity, but it happens anyway because you're not really capable of like saying shush, shush, don't worry about it, because you do.
Right. So, do you find this in certain locations, like certain growers in like rural areas, maybe more so, or is it the generation, or like what? How do you handle it?
I think it's more of an age thing. I really do. So, and just because more of our young growers are more towards the city because they're doing that whole like new urban farming thing. So I don't think it's necessarily because city versus rural. I think it's mostly an age thing. And I think a lot of it is just like not knowing what to say because they haven't really experienced very many female extension personnel in general. Mm-hmm.
Do you have to maybe break the ice in a different way or just kind of show them what you know? Like, how do you get out there and prove yourself so they, you know, turn around and listen and say, like, wow, she really does know her stuff and it doesn't really matter anymore?
Yeah, that's kind of my strategy, is just, like, rocking it, like, just generally rocking it and then hoping, like, look here, this is me and this is what I do. If you don't think this is good enough, then I guess tough toenails.
Yeah.
And that's harder to do when it's just like a meet and greet or like an on-farm visit sort of thing, because there's not as much of a chance to demonstrate. Like, if you're demonstrating all you know on a farm visit, that's kind of bizarre. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's like an actual extension, like event where you're giving a talk, like I've had nothing but positive interactions from those because people get to talk to you after.
Right. They see you now. Right. Well, that's good. Some of the questions that I have actually have to do with maybe what the climate is in entomology departments when you were a student. Did you have a good mentor? And did you see challenges, I guess, getting into a faculty position after your PhD?
So my mentors both were really, really awesome. And I don't know, like, people talk about being really deliberate in choosing a mentor and talking to their other students. And I didn't follow any of the rules, and I think I just got lucky. So both of them were very great about like opening doors, especially if I specifically said, hey, I want this experience. They're like, okay, go do it. And, you know, it didn't have to be like, you need to be writing papers 24/7. If I wanted to go do a training on campus, that I thought would be good for me, they said, go ahead and have at it. So yeah, I was just kind of a lucky duck in that aspect. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't really ever have issues with any of my mentors. There were some random, I almost feel sometimes like academia, because we, you know, we always talk about interacting with growers, and we have this mental image of like this gruff old white guy that's going to be mean to women. But sometimes I feel like it's more the academics as opposed to these farmers that are kind of mean to women sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any run-ins or experiences with some other faculty members that are male?
I don't know if I just give off a vibe that, because so anytime somebody does do something like that, I cut it off pretty much in the moment if it's directed at me, because I tend to snark back.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, if it's some kind of snippy, snarky comment, I joke right back at them as if we're having a good time and we're all just joking, right? Mm-hmm. And so they tend to stop. Whereas I've noticed other women who be interacting with the same person and have a lot more issues because they don't feel comfortable doing that, or that's not their personality, right? Like, that's just not normal behavior for them.
Yeah.
I've seen that, and it's just like, what are you doing? Stop it.
Yeah. No, it's hard if you don't have that kind of personality, right?
Right.
And so, you know,
that's how I respond to a friend that teased me too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so you just turn that on all the time.
Yeah. No, I understand that. Are there any things that you would suggest for young women in entomology or science to do to be as competitive, to be able to not have to be on the defense, like, so that they, you know, can compete for the jobs without having to be the token female?
Well, first, I would say, like, in any scenario where someone says you're the token female, they're full of hot nonsense. Mm-hmm. Like, there is no difference, especially considering how many people are applying for these jobs, between candidate number one in everyone's brain and probably candidate number 10. Like, it's all just varying degrees of different kinds of experience as opposed to one being clearly better or worse.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, that they're inviting you to campus, basically, you know, you're in the top three. That means it's just a matter of them deciding whether or not you're a fit. So if you get accepted and somebody's telling you you're there because of a woman, that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's good advice.
That's just like, so be aware of that, I think, because somebody sooner or later is probably going to say, hey, you're the token woman, you're the token minority, or something along those lines. And knowing that it's not true and that it's their problem and not yours is, I think, first thing first. Mm-hmm. Even if you are the only female in the department, they picked you because you're good.
Mm-hmm. That's good. It's a good way to look at it.
So I actually recently, like maybe a month ago, went to like a women in academia sort of event, and one person who was an administrator actually said, you know, when I started out like looking for jobs, that paper came out, and I forget what the factor was, but I'll just make up a number, that a woman had to be four times as good on paper as a man to be rated the same and for a position in academia. And she said, so I just went like 30 times as good to make sure I got it. And I guess I want to tell, like, young women that are just starting out in their careers to not worry about that, because I think that we get this idea in our head to go, oh, no, then I have to do that. And because we're already, I think, socially conditioned to put so much pressure on ourselves as women to be successful, one, because we're thought of as representing women in science, and, like, have all this internal pressure that, like, don't listen to the external pressure if at all possible. And I know that's kind of hard to do. But yeah, don't think that you have to be four times as good or 10 times as good or whatever amount times as good to be successful. Just do you. And that probably already will be 20 or 30 times as good because you're not doing the math right in your head, I promise.
That's really good advice. What do you think is one of the reasons, or part of the reasons why there's, you know, in graduate school in entomology, there's male and female, probably, you know, equal amounts. And then as we move up into faculty positions or in academia, possibly in industry, that there aren't as many women.
I think some of it is a thing that we're fixing generationally, like, you know, 40 years ago or whatever, people weren't hiring as many women, and so that's why there are fewer senior faculty, period, and it's a problem that's been fixed to some extent through more thoughtful hiring processes. But also I think that, you know, the pipeline's still kind of leaky. Like, you hear from folks that leave science because they were either, like, outright harassed, made to feel like they didn't belong there. or just decided it wasn't for them, and then you kind of maybe look at what it wasn't for me meant, and it meant that the system wasn't very accommodating of someone that, say, wanted to be a really, like, involved parent, which discriminates against women, or somebody that wanted to, you know, actually give birth to a child, which, again, discriminates against women. I think it's both things. Like, it's something we're fixing, but also the pipeline is still leaking.
Do you think there's anything that we can do to prevent that in the future?
I think further implementing really thoughtful hiring processes. There's no reason for people to be asking people, like, what their marital status is during an interview, but I've heard it happen. So there are still, like, old school things that need to be fixed. But then in terms of new school things, making it an environment where, you know, parents that are equal partners in a relationship in terms of who's doing the at-home and child care are able to go to conferences, or maybe conferences aren't weighted so heavily in decisions about who's successful and who's not. All these little things that can be done to make the environment more accommodating to people that have roles in the household or who are women. Mm-hmm. And then really, I think a lot of it comes down to both individual behavior, like calling out when individual people are not behaving correctly, and then also fixing the system. So we've kind of got to hit it to both ends.
Yeah. Is that something that you are worried about moving forward as faculty, trying to balance everything? Or are you, I mean, you sound like an awfully confident person. I love your attitude. I hope that this is something that, you know, the up and coming women, girls, scientists, everyone has that confidence so that they can push through the hard times, you know, in adversity. You know, I don't know. That gives me hope. Some of the conversations I've had with other people on Twitter and otherwise, you know, they're really wanting to know what it's like nowadays and hoping that there are changes, coming through. What's your outlook for women in entomology, moving forward?
It definitely looks better, especially if you account for, like, how many students there were that were women in entomology, like, 20 or 30 years ago. Like, we're starting to actually get people into the pipeline. Mm-hmm. The issue before is people, you know, the gates were barred. So now it's a question of supporting them along the way and realizing, like, that people who are embracing either traditionally feminine roles or people who have elder care or child care have different needs than maybe what we think of as a typical professor or typical, you know, industry professional, where you're assuming that it's, you know, the one spouse does all the work and can depend upon the other spouse entirely for taking care of the house and the kids. Well, that's just not realistic anymore. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, making sure we've got supports for people who've been wronged in terms of both the discrimination and harassment, even when it's subtle.
Those are great ideas. Is there anything else you want to add about anything about, you know, your situation and the things that you do, where we could find you, some of your things you want to plug?
Oh, man. So, you know, just starting out, I definitely just want to plug my people. So I have a really fantastic postdoc who's also on Twitter. Her name's Monica Farfan. She goes by her full name on Twitter, so you can find her and follow her. I have a new lab website, which is schmidtint.com, which I hope that I'm going to regularly update. We all know how that sometimes goes.
Yes.
And, like, I think if I wanted to leave with any final thoughts, it's a reminder to people that, like, you can be a really great feminist and then not pay attention to intersectionality in your feminism. So I think it's really important to be aware that we're not, like, punching down on people who are maybe, like, trans women, who are racial or ethnic minorities, to people who are not, you know, typically gender conforming or have different sexual orientations. Like, be aware that, like, you can be a feminist and only be supporting white women who are, you know, none of those things, and that's also being not very good at being a feminist. So so keep that in mind.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.